Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
This week in Retronauts, age is just a number, and it makes you dumber. Everyone, welcome to this episode of Retronauts. I am Jeremy Parrish, hosting this episode of Retronauts with such cool people in the recording studio as
Ben Elgin,
Ben Jedwards,
Chris Sims,
and no pithy nicknames or anything this time. Nope, we're just getting straight down to business.
Yeah,
and the business is talking about the year 2009.
This is our, like, what, third attempt at finishing this series, now that we're halfway through the year?
So earlier in the year, we did the year in review, and, you know, went back through, like, 1989, 1969, 79,
yeah, 99. That was our problem.
Yeah. lots of video games every 10 years, every decade. And we got to 2000, or to 1999, and said, okay, cool, we're done. But then everyone started thinking, you know, actually there was a lot of interesting stuff in 2009, and that was 10 years ago, which means that by our very arbitrary standard, that is retro now. So I thought, why not just get back together and just talk about 2009 in gaming? Because, I don't know, like, with 10 years of hindsight, you can see how 2009 was kind of transitional. Like, it was a very different place than gaming in 1999. But it was also pretty different than what we have now. Like, gaming has shifted and evolved a whole lot. I kind of feel like that period was sort of this interminable gray area of video gaming. I mean, I was working in the press and covering video games is my living. But when I look back, I'm like, I don't know if I really want to revisit that. But I don't know. Maybe that's just...
No. It was a golden age.
Was it?
Compared to now, yes. Definitely.
Compared to now?
Yes.
We were just talking earlier about
socially,
how much great games...
Socially, I think it was a good age.
Socially, we were in the middle of a recession and everyone that I knew got laid off.
I mean, like, video games weren't as extremely political and politicized as they are now. And 2009 was the beginning of the new indie revolution, or 2007 or so. But
yeah,
it was
video
still
games
going.
Have always been political, I hate to tell you.
Yeah, but I mean, that time, it was a good mixture of sort of like the old ways and the new ways. Things were, you know, people were, I don't even want to get into it.
Okay, let me see if I can
actually, I'm not sure where you're going.
Old ways? Let's not.
The old ways is like playing a game without talking about politics and enjoying it with your friends, no matter who you are and what background you come from. That's video games to me.
Yeah, that wasn't actually how it was back then. Maybe that was your experience.
It was for me.
Yeah. So you liked the state of video games that existed for you in 2009, not necessarily like the broader spectrum of video games.
I mean, there were issues and problems that were coming up and things were, I don't even want to talk about. But, you know, it was a cool
time.
Did you
ever play the Grand Theft Auto games?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
did you play like Manhunt? Did you play Civilization? Like,
which one?
BioShock. Of these games had you know, they had political themes. They had approached social issues. I think you just have rose tinted glasses, but realistically, video games, you know, by the nature of what they are, they're political. Like, there's a perspective, there's a point of view. So
yeah, there's the first game on this list that we have starts off with a disclaimer about how it was made by people of many different backgrounds.
Yes.
Yeah, the first game on this list
is a sequel
to a game where you play as a Muslim assassin, murdering Christian crusaders.
Yeah.
That's you know, that was a pretty big deal at the time.
Too.
Yes, it was accurate. Yeah. But it was also like in 2007 when that game came out, Assassin's Creed. Mm-hmm. That was quite a stand to take. Like, especially, you know, the atmosphere of Islamophobia that was really prevalent in America at the time, you know, post 9/11, to have a character who was Muslim that you know, and not American, and was just going around stabbing Christian crusaders in the back. That was a stand. That was a statement. And that's why Assassin's Creed 2 had the all creeds and, yeah, and ethnicities.
All
and
Assassin's Creeds.
Yeah, like, yeah. So yeah, I can't agree with you there, Benj.
I'll put this out there. 2009 was pre-mainstream Twitter, okay? That's what I'm talking about. It's like
It's about the channels you're experiencing games.
Yeah, well, I'm saying like there's a different relationship between fans and creators at that time. There's a different relationship between the media and the creators at that time than there is now. There's a different relationship between readers and the media than there is now.
I think it was a transitional period.
Yeah, transitional period. But it was neat. You know, blogs were sort of giving way to social media at that mm-hmm. time, and it was, you know, and YouTube was rising in prominence. And
yeah, I think there's a lot of ways in which the online scene was transitional. And we had online in this, and you know, we had YameFax and we had forums and blogs and stuff. We didn't have like sort of the immediate super of the moment discussion that we have on Twitter now. And it was also transitional just in terms of where the games come from. Like you had online game stores already by this time, but they weren't, I feel like they weren't as pervasive as they are now, where you've got new stuff coming out just constantly downloadable.
The reason I say this was kind of an interminable gray period is because at the time, this was where, you know, like middle tier video games pretty much disappeared. And so you had blockbuster games, and indie games were really struggling to get mm-hmm. started. Mm-hmm. So everything was dominated by big, big blockbuster games, everything that had to sell, you know, millions of dollars, and kind of got us to the point where we are now, where if a game, you know, it's a best-selling game for months in a row, but somehow doesn't meet shareholder objectives, then it's still considered a failure, and everyone loses their job.
You didn't have the constant indie pipeline that we have now, where you'll have these little indie games, and then they start to catch on, and then they end up being published on all the console stores, and everyone gets them, and they get really popular. You didn't really have that so much. So this was kind of a transition where before you had the big console games, and then if a console was successful enough, you'd also get maybe some more experimental stuff published for it. But it still wasn't really indie. You had to be picked up by like some company that was going to do your console publishing for you.
When did the Xbox Live store open? 2008?
It was
before that, wasn't it?
It was early. It was definitely
opening. I mean,
Xbox
Live was available pretty much from the launch of the 360, which was 2005, because Geometry Wars was...
No, it was a few years later. I'm positive.
So how were people playing Geometry Wars?
I don't know. Maybe that was a mainstream release.
How are they getting horse armor for Oblivion in 2006?
My experience...
I don't know, but I know it wasn't at the launch of the console. But there... Oh, Xbox Live Arcade came out in 2008.
That was
that's why I'm talking about this era as a really exciting period of like the ascent of the indies. And you know, you've watched Indie Game, the movie that profiles certain high profile indie, you know, pioneers of that time. And that was that period of that stuff going on with Fez and Super Meat Boy and, you know, and Minecraft, by the way, coming and revolutionizing everything in that year and the next years that followed, which is pretty exciting.
So I think you've actually kind of touched on something, maybe inadvertently, that I wanted to talk about in this episode, which was, you know, so much of what we're going to talk about in this episode is going to be colored by subjectivity, by, you know, through the lens of how we saw the world at the time. I mean, you've already talked about the lack of mainstream Twitter, the fact that we didn't have a president who was like telling senators that they need to go back to Africa on Twitter.
No, I didn't.
So my question then is, where were you in 2009? Chris, let's start with you.
2009 was actually a really big year for me personally. I was transitioning out of having a day job and into being a full-time writer. I had been blogging since 2005, a comics blog that it's still out there. You can still find it. The more recent archives are at the-isb.com. But in 2009, I had started writing for Comics Alliance, which was then run by AOL. Laura Hudson hired me for that job.
Ah, wow. I haven't heard that name in a while.
Yeah, me neither.
I was just talking to Laura the other day. So cool.
Tell her we said hi.
I will. But she hired me based on things that I had written on my blog. And so I was able to, at the end of 2009, beginning of 2010, transition out of working at a comic book store where I'd worked for 6 years and into full-time freelance writing, which is where I've been ever since. And I had been writing all along, but it became my day job, which also meant that I was working from home, which also meant that I was playing more video games. So for me personally, I remember this time very intensely. And oddly enough, looking at this list of games that we had, there were so many of them that I didn't play at the time that I would later go back to. Like Assassin's Creed 2, I waited for a while to go back to. But obviously, given what my job was, what my interests are, and who I am as a person, like, Arkham Asylum was a huge, huge game for me, just personally. But yeah, that's about where I was. And I was also writing about video games at the time, like, more for myself than anything else.
Binge, how about yourself? Clearly you were not on Twitter interacting with the president.
That's actually, well, it was the first year I joined Twitter was 2009. I was a little late to the game. I had friends who started in 2006 or whatever, but in 2009 was a really good year.
Yeah, by 2009, I had already joined Twitter, used it for like a year or two, quit, and then started a new account.
Yeah. I feel like 2009 was sort of the beginning of mainstream adoption of Twitter, which is probably why I started in the beginning.
That's why all the media sites went away.
When did Google Reader die? Because I feel like you could put the pin in Google Reader dying as the transition from blogs and honestly like a lot of content-driven websites to social media and social media.
2012?
When did LiveJournal get sold? 2011, 2012, somewhere in there.
When did LiveJournal get sold? Because I was on LiveJournal for a long time in the early 2000s, but then it just died completely.
It was bought by Russians and now it's very popular in Russia.
Yeah, it was already popular in Russia. That's why the Russians bought it, so they could clamp down on all the dissidents who were on there. Literally, that's true.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Well, 2009 was a big year for me. 2009 was a big year. I was writing freelance for many sites like PC World and Mac World a lot, and Technologizer, a new blog started by my buddy Harry McCracken, and just cranking out the hits. And I had a blog called Vintage Computing and Gaming that I still run, but I was still updating it back then a lot. And it was a good time, and I was expecting my first child at that period. So it was for me personally, it was the beginning of a transition, because the next year everything changed with a baby, you know. So 2009 was like my last year as a free man. Yeah, it was like someone who could actually sit down and play video games for more than an hour straight, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, I knew Jeremy at the time, and that's probably when I stopped writing for 1UP around then. And
that's because 1UP stopped having any money.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It happened a lot, but it was still, the money was fairly good in freelancing at that time until a couple of years later. So I was doing pretty well and it was fun. I was establishing a lot of new, like, things that hadn't been written about before, but that's a little personal. So
1UP was ahead of the curve in a lot of ways, including, being bellwethers of the transition away from mainstream publishing.
I agree completely. Mm-hmm. Yes. It was exciting. Yeah.
So 2009 for me, 2009 was a very like sort of middle stretch of my life. I had, I graduated from grad school in like 2000. I was doing this tech job, that I was still in 2009. It would be for a while. And, you know, I also got married in 2000 and that also lasted about the same amount of time. This was a very stable period of my life, which meant that I actually had time to play video games. So I played a bunch of all the good stuff that was coming out in this year.
PS3 at that time. You know, that was what I was gaming on a lot.
And wait, a PC. PS3? Or
PS3,
yeah. Yeah, PS3. Yeah, okay.
What about you, Ben?
I had PS3 and a DS.
Yeah, a DS. I had a DS as well.
I would have been Wii, 360, DS. I think that's...
the main stuff.
I know at some point I did buy a Neo Geo Pocket Color.
That was 10 years before.
Okay.
Yeah. So. And this was actually a diversification for me because I had always been a one platform guy. Like I had the NES and Super Nintendo and then I moved to PlayStation. But I hadn't actually had a handheld since I had a hand-me-down original brick Game Boy from one of my cousins. And then I sort of fell away from handhelds for a long time until the DS just had so much good stuff on it that I finally caved with one of the Zeldas and started picking up stuff on that.
Yeah, as for myself, I was working at 1UP.com and we really hit a stride in 2008 and everything was great. And going into 2009, I had lots of ideas for content. I really took an initiative to break out topic-specific blogs on the site, focusing on the brand new world of iPhone gaming. But also there was a retro gaming blog, a game music blog, a movie and DVD release blog. And I was in charge of that and it was great. And then about a week into the year, the layoffs hit and 2/3 of the staff was laid off and I was still there. And a lot of other people were still there, but it totally changed everything, changed the nature of this show, Retronauts, back in the 1UP era. That was kind of the start for the year, but we still made the best of it. And, from that point on, I was kind of trying to figure out exactly what my angle on gaming was, because I was like, well, I don't want to just do old stuff. Clearly that's what stuck. But, I was interested in more critical analysis. And I tried to stay ahead of and abreast of gaming. And it's weird because I had a whole lot more time for actually playing games back then. I feel like now I just don't have time to play anything current. I've got so many projects going on, and they've all kind of shifted toward old content. So that's pretty much all I play. But yeah, I look at this list of major games in 2009, and I would say probably 3/4 of them I played. And yeah, it was a pretty solid year. But at the same time, I look at it and I can see kind of how the video games industry was in some ways losing its sense of direction and moving more toward, the desperate monetization that we see now, games as a service and things like that, subscription services. We weren't quite there yet, but I think the writing was on the wall, especially with the launch of iOS gaming at the end of 2008. Definitely. That really kind of drove a hammer into the coffin of portable gaming for a while. Portable gaming eventually clawed its way out of the grave and came back, but it was a tough battle. And I was primarily playing on DS and 360 as my platforms. Mm-hmm. So, when I wasn't playing games on 360, all the rest of the time I was playing stuff on DS or PSP to a certain degree, but it was kind of fading by that point. Watching DS start to struggle at that point, that was the year that, you really started to see the market shrivel up for DS. And I think that's because of piracy and because of iOS. And that took a toll, because before that, the DS had been very vibrant. So, yeah, I don't know. I have mixed feelings about 2009. Lots of great games, but also lots of challenges that would kind of come to light in the coming years.
Yeah, I mean, there was still a lot of really good stuff coming out on DS right now, but I think it was stuff that had been in the pipeline still coming out in 2009.
Yeah, I want to say this was the year that Atlus went all in on just releasing all kinds of crazy esoteric stuff on DS,
the thing is that even
Steel Princess and things like that, mm-hmm. they had a dozen games, really niche RPGs. They were man, this market's awesome. Everything's rocking. And those games sold 10 copies each. And I think they took a bath on them.
Well, the thing is that even though stuff was winding down, the DS had done so well at this point that it had an enormous install base. And that, right? Didn't it?
But
I think that in some sense, gave people a sense of comfort in just taking some risks on shoving stuff out there, because so many people on this platform that someone was going to buy it.
It did, but so much of this install base was R4. I can get one of those. Sure.
Right, sure.
I think this was the year that I went to a family wedding and saw a bunch of kids playing DS, and I was like, oh, what are you playing? And they were like, I don't know, everything. And they just scrolled through our list of games on their R4s, and I was like, oh, well, okay. Mm-hmm. That's a game that just came out last week, and you did not buy it. All right.
Yeah. I had an R4 around that time, but I found it that it was I used it as a demoing system. Mm-hmm. I actually bought way more DS games after I got the R4 than I did before.
But yeah, I did have an exception. One, but
I mean, I have a ton of DS games, and I got to play the ones I liked and figure them out and not waste my money on the ones I didn't like.
Yeah, I had one, but I didn't really, and you know, this isn't a holier than thou thing, it's just the way I used it, but yeah, I didn't really put new games on it. I was more like old stuff and had some emulators on there, and yeah.
So at that time, with the R4, I was like, wouldn't it be great if Nintendo embraced this and made it so you could just download a game or try it out, and you know.
Well, and there was a shop on there, but...
Yeah, there were they didn't have a
DS
or no, sorry, that
no,
was
that that was until the DSi. Not,
okay, yeah,
that was
portable. That the DSi was where that started. Yes, DSi was where that started. Yeah,
I didn't
so
even know that
off,
was. A,
we're a year off from that.
I didn't know that was a thing. I didn't know you could play pirated games on DS at the time.
Oh yeah,
wow.
The R4 was out of made it insanely easy.
Yeah, you
very
just bought this
convenient
SD card or cart.
Yeah, and that's why they released the DSi.
In fact, in 2008, on the way to Game Developers Conference, I sat next to Ralph Baer on the plane with a DS Lite, the inventor of video games. I had an R4 in there, and we just sat and played through four or five games together. It was really cool. Thanks to the R4.
So piracy is good because it lets you play games with the father of video games.
Yep. That's
great. Pirate responsibly, kids.
The rise of the App Store opened in 2008, the iOS App Store. Yeah, that's the race to the bottom began as soon as that came out. Everyone's chasing the bottom dollar.
Quite as soon as it came out. There was like a year of grace where people were like, they put a legitimate effort into it. But then,
killed everything was the in-app purchases, and then they allowed the advertising in games, and that really, really killed iOS games. Because I bought... For a year or so, there were so many good iOS games on the iPad and stuff that were just games. You just bought them and you played them, and they were wonderful. They didn't have; they weren't begging you for more money. They weren't tricking you.
You paid $4.99 and you owned the game.
Yeah, it was wonderful. And so I still have an iPad 1 full of those games, and I'm going to keep it forever. My kids play it because that's what was my daughter's first platform, basically. As even like a 6 month old, she was like playing with Mitzi Bitsy Spider and stuff, and then she got into Minecraft on there, and oh man, so that was that era.
Maybe we should talk about Minecraft first, because it is 10 years old now based on the initial dev releases, and I think, you know, even at the time that it came out, I don't know if everyone here heard about it, but I was definitely aware of it. Because you kind of had to be by being in the games media.
Yeah. But it was still kind of a niche thing for a while.
It was niche, but it just kind of immediately turned into this snowball. Like, wow, this is really cool. And this is, you know, you immediately started seeing people do these huge projects that they would just take on. You know, like, I just built the USS Enterprise D and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I think that might have been a year or two later. But, you know, from the very beginning, there was a lot of pickup with Minecraft.
The first year I played Minecraft is 2009. There was like a free version you could play through the browser or something and build whatever you wanted. And then there was the alpha that you could download, and it was a Java app. And Notch just kept adding features and adding features and adding features all the time. So I had a best friend guy. I mean, once they added – first we were playing it individually. Then he added multiplayer. And when we had multiplayer, I had a friend online who we would – build a whole new world, and then a new release would come out, and we'd just start all over again. We did that five times over the next few years, and it was really fun and addictive, and it was exciting to see what would be added to the game, because at that point, it was a bunch of really necessary and cool additions. At this point, I feel like they've gone way overboard with too many additions, but that's just me personally, because it's 10 years old. But one of the funny things I remember the most at the time of 2009, 2010 Minecraft is that everyone was worried. Notch always intended the torches to run out eventually. And so everyone was worried in the Minecraft community, like, oh my God, Notch is going to make the torches run out. Because that ruins the whole game. You've established the world with torches so monsters don't spawn and you can survive. Because there's only survival mode. And there was only, you know, and there was no adventure mode with HP and whatever. Correct. And so
the monsters stay away from the light.
Experience points. Yeah, they stay away from the light. They don't spawn in the light. So you have to establish your base, basically, in your safe space with these torches that always glow. And then there's the rumor always that he was going to make them run out. And they're like, that will ruin Minecraft forever.
So who's this this Notch you keep mentioning? I thought the inventor of Minecraft was Hatsune Miku.
Marcus Persson.
Who we don't really want to talk about too much.
I don't know who Miku is. But
Hatsune Miku? She's a Vocaloid. Sega's virtual idol character. Basically, people have said, oh, Notch is actually not a great person to look up to. So they've just kind of...
That's the thing. You don't have to look up to him. But he still created Minecraft.
He didn't, though. He wasn't... It's not like he was the sole creator of this series, this game. Like, he was a creator, but there were lots of people involved in the creation of Minecraft. He was kind of the public face and the driving figure, but, you know, he wasn't the sole person responsible for it. And there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of talk and a lot of kind of oral history about how when, you know, Microsoft bought Minecraft and from Mojang, and I think he took like a $2 billion paycheck from that. And, you know, the other people who worked in the company benefited, but not nearly to that degree. And,
I'm sorry?
Yeah, $2 billion.
I thought it was
like
billion.
With a B?
Yeah,
with
a billion.
I thought it was a billion.
That's why he owns a candy mansion.
Yeah.
Yep.
This is how I feel about Notch is that, like, I try to separate the creator from their art.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know? By all means, Minecraft is a brilliant piece of work. It was created collectively, not just by Marcus Persson.
Yeah. There were many staff members. I don't remember their names, but I remember updates, and the guy who took it over was the main guy after Notch left.
I don't really know my Minecraft individuals that well. I just know that he basically cashed out and became a recluse and just kind of exists as social like post to be awful on social media.
And went off.
But I don't want to talk about him too much.
Yeah.
Like I just wanted to kind of clarify that he was not the single-handed. Mastermind. He's not like a Will Wright. He was not like, I had a great idea, I'm going to do it all by myself. This was no raid on Bungling Bay or whatever.
If I had $2,000, you would never see or hear from me again.
$2,000?
$2 billion. By $2,000, I'd be pretty happy.
Shit, I got that.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Right,
I'm not sure.
If I had $2 billion, I would be gone.
Yeah, I would.
Not posting on Twitter.
I would definitely
disappear.
Yeah, I definitely would not buy a candy mansion.
But I think I always thought it was kind of surprising that I didn't get into Minecraft when it was the new hotness, because I love building things. But I think the problem was back then, actually similar to now, I don't tend to do a lot of like PC desktop gaming. I mostly am on my consoles and handhelds, and it took a long time for it to get there. You can get it on consoles now.
I'll tell you why I liked Minecraft. Exactly. Two reasons. First is that you could build and create your own world to your specifications. Mm-hmm. And I came from a world of mushes, these text-based virtual worlds, mm-hmm. multiplayer worlds, where people could build their own worlds and program in text.
A world full of mush.
See the Retronauts early online episode where we talked about that too much.
Yeah, that's true. We did talk about mushes. So Minecraft to me felt like the most obvious graphical extension of mushes up to that point. It wasn't Second Life. It wasn't whatever, because Minecraft, it took something very complicated. How do you build something in 3D space and make it easy? It simplified it and summarized it down into blocks with simple blocks, block-based system. It's not like you got to program a whole car and make yourself look like a hamburger in Second Life and whatever, all this weird stuff that was really obscure, like 3D modeling involved, you know. But anyone can block out a voxel picture of anything in Minecraft, and it makes it so accessible and so addictive. Of course, when you had to mine the resources to do it before creative mode was a common thing, you just wanted to keep doing it and keep going and finding things. And boy, it was exciting. And the random generation of the world, the procedural generation, you know, new things that you don't know and that weren't planned out were coming in.
That's a really good point, though. The simplicity of the system makes it open to anyone doing anything without being beholden to like other people creating content to modify.
It's like your game, kind of.
Yeah, Minecraft came about 10 years too late for me to be able to invest time in it. But I love that it existed because it really, to me, felt like the realization of the novel Microsurfs. Did you ever read that? Mm. Douglas Copeland's Microsurfs?
Nope.
I know.
That was a huge formative work for me in college. That was from like 1995, 96. And it was about some people who have an idea for a game, like what if we could create like virtual Lego, and they leave their cushy jobs at Microsoft and start this little company and create something that is basically, it's basically Minecraft. And it took almost 15 years for someone to actually create the game described in microserves. But when it finally came out, I was like, this is it. This is like, people have tried to make virtual Lego simulations and they were terrible, but this is the real thing. This is a building experience. And now, you know, this game was huge. It is one of the biggest games of all time. I don't know how many hundreds of millions of downloads it's had. It's on every platform imaginable, including 3DS. Like, you know, Rebecca Heineman and I think I want to say Other Ocean programmed a new 3DS version of Minecraft.
Wasn't that Mike was involved?
Yes, Mike Micah was involved. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was an impressive piece of work, but it's everywhere. You can play it on anything.
Plushy toys of little pixely tools at Walmart.
Little Steve explodes as they turned it into actual Legos. It's so recursive. But the DNA of Minecraft shows up in so many contemporary games. Fortnite is Minecraft, but with, you know, battle royale combat. Dragon Quest Builders 1 and 2 is a brilliant extrapolation of Minecraft into the role playing genre. It's just such a fertile basis for a game. And, you know, my nephews and nieces still play Minecraft constantly.
For my children, my oldest daughter is 9. She's been playing Minecraft since she was 4 years old, nonstop. So 5 years of the same game as it grew and changed. This is like, that's her generation's bellwether of gaming. I mean, Minecraft, who knows how long it's going to keep going. Of course, we thought that for World of Warcraft that it'd go forever, but, you know.
Yeah, but World of Warcraft was still more finite in scope and more limited. Like, it was for a specific audience. Minecraft is just like
a platform.
If you want to make something, go build it. Go dig a hole and start building a castle. Or, you know, one time I sat down with my nephew and he loved the 8-bit style amiibo. And he was like, I want to build those in Minecraft. So we sat down and we spent an afternoon building 8-bit Mario and 8-bit Link, like exactly to the specifications of the amiibo. And it's a great like creative tool, like a way for kids to express themselves. But also, you know, if you want to sit down with them and share something with them, it's a very fun and painless way to do it.
And they're apparently working on now the AR version of this. So like Pokemon Go style thing where you can go out and build your Minecraft stuff and leave it in the real world and have other people with their phones come out and see it.
Yeah, I played the HoloLens version of Minecraft.
Yeah, like, so they did
4 or 5 years ago.
Demos of this in the works for a while, but apparently like the phone game is actually getting close to where they're actually going to be able to do it, I think.
Chris, do you have opinions about Minecraft?
Never played it. Never will.
Never will.
Don't get it. Don't understand it.
What?
You sound like the oldest man in the room, even though you're the youngest one.
I am the youngest person in the room, and this is my oldest old man opinion. I don't get it.
It's just a place to build. And
build. Why?
Yeah. You sound like my brother.
Because, why not?
But why?
I mean, why do anything?
Fun. I got a job. If I'm going to sit down and create something, that's work. I got to fight a Dracula. Give me a Dracula fight.
I think there are some Draculas in Minecraft. There's definitely the Cthulhus.
Let me tell you, my brother said the same thing. I tried to get him into Minecraft. He was like, why the heck would you sit down and just build anything and do anything? It's like, it was way too open for him. He wanted a narrated, curated experience from a video game that guided him through it. Is that how you feel?
Yeah, I mean, like, I bear no ill will towards anyone. I am not, like, against Minecraft. But, like, I cannot see the appeal. And admittedly, I have never played it, but I've never seen anything that made me want to play it. And I remember at this time and in the following years, like, I would also see, Jeremy, like you mentioned, like, oh, somebody built the Enterprise. Somebody built a clock that works or whatever.
Yeah.
And I was like, why?
Somebody built an entire Atari 2600 emulator in Minecraft with, like, this.
Like, out of redstone switches?
Stuff
like
that.
Oh, my God.
Or command blocks and stuff.
Insane. Why not? Like, why would someone sit down with a blank piece of paper and draw something? Because they want to express themselves.
Because at the end of it, you have a thing.
Yeah, well, in Minecraft, you have a thing. And you can share it with people.
You have an imaginary thing. That's not a real thing.
Social.
Yes. Just because something exists in a virtual space.
Yeah, but again, this is why I have gotten into cooking lately, because literally all day, all I do is I wake up and I create things that don't actually exist. Like, I write things, or I write
You can
scripts.
Argue that Minecraft objects, that creations in Minecraft are more real than food because so many people can interact with them. So many people can share them and experience them.
That's
the worst argument I've ever heard.
That's the weirdest argument that a Minecraft object is more real than a sandwich.
When you eat a sandwich, it's gone. What proof do you have aside from maybe some indigestion or a good poop later?
First of all, my sandwiches are great and do not cause indigestion. How dare you?
I'm saying, like, maybe you use some, you know, a blot of mustard or a bad potato.
Crumb of.
And then I would see Christmas
carols. Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. By all means, have fun. I know the children like it, but I'm not a child. I got a job, so it ain't for me.
Damn. That's cold, right, man. That's cold.
On the other hand, you are the world's foremost Batmanologist, yes. So...
Yeah.
Again, it's all about priorities. I have enough stuff that doesn't exist.
Okay.
Your preferred stuff that doesn't exist is elsewhere. That's fine.
And to be fair, like, I do kind of get it because but like for me, that impulse is taken care of by like
cooking.
Lego. Writing D&D adventures. Like I run D&D games for my friends, and around this time would have been when I was getting into the Dungeon Master side of things. Mm-hmm. So creating these imaginary things that don't exist and then having people interact with them, I get that in a certain respect. Yeah. I don't get having to work within someone else's limitations to do it.
I would say that Minecraft isn't necessarily working within limitations. It's just
it's a
nature of the medium.
It's a framework.
You have to interact with something else. I can sit down and write whatever I want. And admittedly, I am using a pre-existing rule system, but like I can break those as I see fit.
I mean, if you sit down with a paint set, you can paint whatever you want, but you're still working within paint. And there are limitations and rules that apply to oil paints versus acrylic paint versus watercolor. You just need to know what the boundaries are.
And this ties back to what Ben was saying. Like, and, you know, I mean, anything that's like online and is using somebody's framework is going to have that framework to work within. But the fact that this is broken down into just like blocks makes it super flexible compared to something where you're actually like using someone else's models or there's already a world there or whatever.
It's accessible to anyone. Even a child can put down blocks and build something, just like a Lego set.
And I'm not a child. So
well, that's fine.
So you lack the capabilities of a child, is what you're saying.
You didn't.
Yes. I'm ready to talk about Arkham Asylum.
Are you smarter than a fifth grader?
Yes.
I was 28 when I first played Minecraft, and I enjoyed it quite a bit.
No, like, again, I am sort of playing it up for humorous effect, but like I have never seen anything that makes me want to play it.
That's fine.
I'm just happy that this 2009 retrospective turned into an existential argument about Minecraft.
Yeah, but whether objects in Minecraft are more real than a sandwich. Ready Player One?
What proof do you have that you made a sandwich last night? I can go downstairs and load up my Wii U and show you the virtual Mario amiibo that my nephew and I created.
Okay, well, I will continue living in a few days, and you will die if that is all you have. If all I have is a sandwich and all you have is Minecraft, then I will continue to live.
That's actually an even worse argument.
My last word on Minecraft is in 2009, I wrote 10 greatest PC games of all time for PC World. It was the weirdest, craziest thing I ever wrote, and number one was like World of Warcraft or something. If I had written it a couple of years later, I would have put Minecraft at number one. That's how I feel about that game.
For the record, I also have never played World of Warcraft and never will.
Yeah, I have zero interest in that.
Yeah.
And again, Minecraft came 10 years too late for me to actually get anything out of it because I just have way too much going on in my life. Mm-hmm. But
yeah. And also, you like talk about people being able to interact with things, but like I have also never gotten into online gaming at all. Like I've never gotten into... The only
so
game
let me tell you something about other people, Chris. They're the worst.
Yes, I know.
Yeah, don't ever play with them. They're terrible.
Like Twitter, in many ways, has made me want to not play Minecraft.
Other humans are terrible and ruin games for you. Play single player games only, but Minecraft is neat because it is single player.
Chris,
if you want it to be,
you can pick your friends. You know that, right?
I know.
Okay, what's the next game? This is the Minecraft.
Anyway. Yeah, okay, so let's talk about some single-player games, maybe.
Yeah, we teased Assassin's Creed 2, so...
All right, I played a lot of that.
Mosey on
the first good Assassin's Creed game.
Yeah. Well, so the first was really interesting and also, like, extraordinarily repetitive. Yeah,
Wonderful concept, mm-hmm. a brilliant idea, an interesting framework, which I think the games quickly outgrew.
Yeah.
In terms of the Abstergo stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Nearly impossible.
Once Kristen Bell left, they were like, well, forget that.
I mean, I played the first Assassin's Creed. I enjoyed it. Like, it had a lot of good ideas. But definitely, like...
It had the three good ideas, and you did them over and over again.
Yeah. Well, I mean, hold the frame.
I enjoyed
like, frame
it,
and
but it was definitely
But yes, it got very repetitive, because in terms of the actual useful things to do in this open world, there were, like, four or five different things, and you did a lot of them.
Assassin's Creed 1 could have used a much narrower focus, because, like, it's very cool, like, oh, you're running around Jerusalem in, mm-hmm. during the Crusades, and it's like...
Now I'm in Accra. Yeah, it's exactly like Jerusalem.
It doesn't need to. I don't need to ride a horse in real time.
Whole like open world between its different cities, which they sort of gave up as the series went on because they realized there was nothing to do in the like empty spaces between where people actually were.
Also, Altair has the classic protagonist problem in that he is not interesting.
Yeah,
like he's doing interesting things in an interesting setting.
I mean, it's
Assassin's Creed 2 fixed that by giving you Ezio.
Ezio is great.
By giving you a Batman origin. And basically, a cool guy.
And his uncle is Mario.
Yeah. I mean, he's kind of an asshole, but that's, you know, a lot of origin stories is him growing out of
it.
Right, exactly. Growing out of being a self-centered asshole.
Altair never grows out of that.
And giving him a great subtextual romantic relationship with Leonardo da Vinci.
Leonardo
da Vinci had to draw some dude naked. It might as well have been Ezio.
Yeah.
Sure.
I think Assassin's Creed 2,
it really hit its stride.
I mean, it has one like big fatal flaw, it's that its reach stretches beyond its grasp, if that makes sense.
I feel like to put this in a Retronox context, it's kind of a Mega Man 1, Mega Man 2 situation.
Very much so.
Like where this was some people's passion and they had a lot of good ideas and the first go was just not quite there.
You can see so much good stuff. It is a game that you play it and you're like, oh, I can't wait to play the sequel to this, mm-hmm. where they figure it out.
Yeah, I mean, Assassin's Creed 2, one of the things I really like about it is that it pulls back into the series' origins. Okay, first of all, Assassin's Creed is a series in which you play as an assassin in a virtual simulation of the main character's genetic ancestry, trying to find secrets for some corporation called Abstergo. None of it matters. The important thing is it focuses on stealth, and it focuses on individual missions in this virtual space where you try to complete according to different objectives, and you can use like direct combat. It has a very Arkham-style, Asylum-esque combat system.
Lots of counters.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But you can also just do stealth kills, like sneak up to people. This made use of what they called, I think, social camouflage, mm-hmm. which was basically like, in the first game, it was like, well, I see some guys in white hoods. I'm going to go pretend I'm a monk.
You can hide in a crowd.
But you can also, like, it got better and more refined as the series advanced. Yeah. And you could hide in, you know, plain sight, basically, to evade enemies. And so... It was a different kind of stealth than Metal Gear had, which was more like a guy sees you and then you have to go hide in the locker.
It gave you they definitely kept revising this as the series went on, but even in the first couple of games, it gave you a lot of options as to how to go about
things. And even if you screw up the stealth, like it is possible.
Yeah.
Not advisable and not easy. It is possible to fight your way out of any situation.
Yeah, the fights tend to go on a long time you're just like parrying, but you can do it. But the series evolved out of an attempt to redefine the Prince of Persia games. Mm-hmm. And Assassin's Creed 2, I think it does a lot of great things, but the best thing it does is that your Tamagotchi, Benj?
I think your Tamagotchi has been beeping this whole time.
I think you need to flush its toilet.
It's hungry. Sorry.
Anyway, yes, it's 2009, but it's also 1999.
There you go. I flushed it. We're good.
Wrong decade.
So Assassin's Creed 2 does a lot of great things, but I love the fact that it makes a conspicuous effort to be more Prince of Persia-like. And there are the cathedral missions, I believe, or the mm-hmm. vaults, which are very much like taking the mechanics of Assassin's Creed, ditching all the combat. There's still some stealth, but they're much more about platforming and navigation and, you know, traveling through these interior spaces as opposed to the rooftops and the streets.
And I loved those. Like, that was some of the most fun platforming I'd had in years and years. I mean, it's still probably up there in the top, like, 3D platforming I've ever done.
And a lot of it is because all of the architecture is, like, has a real world basis. Mm-hmm. So when you're when you're in St. Peter's Basilica, you're in St. Peter's Basilica doing stuff that you
And God, I've been like, I've visited Europe a couple times since I started playing these games, and I cannot look at cathedrals without wanting to climb them anymore.
Which it was. Like, there was one of the Ezio games that I was reviewing. It might have been Assassin's Creed 2. And they kept telling me to go to some place, and it wasn't marked in the map. So I was like, where the hell is this? So I pulled up Rome on Google Maps.
Nice.
And I was like, oh, that's where I need to be.
Rome is
and
actually
sure
the
enough,
second Ezio
okay,
game, I think.
So that was Assassin's Creed Brotherhood?
Yeah, Brotherhood, I think, is Rome.
Yeah,
no, not Brotherhood. It was whatever it was called. Yeah.
Sisterhood?
Revelation? Yes.
No. It was Assassin's Creed 2 and then Brotherhood and then Revelation.
Okay.
Yeah. My wife did a semester in Istanbul. And when how's the Hagia Sophia?
Yes.
Like, did you climb it? Is it cool? It?
But yes, I actually used Google Maps to navigate myself around that game because it was based, you know, on a city that has been largely unchanged in 500, 800, 1,000 years.
And I think Assassin's Creed also, the series as a whole, does a really good job of hitting a sweet spot between accuracy in portraying things from the real world, portraying both locations and historical events and time periods, but massaging it just enough to be a good playable experience.
Yeah, the thing that I always say about Assassin's Creed 2 is it is a game that like assures you it is historically accurate, and then you fight Pope Alexander VI in the secret alien basement.
You kill the Pope.
Well, you knock him out.
You murderize the Pope.
You don't.
You knock out the Pope.
I killed the Pope in one of the games.
You fight Alexander.
I absolutely stabbed him in the face.
That was Kill the Pope 3. You forgot that game.
Plus, like, really, really good character design. Like, I think Altair has a really good, clean design.
The design's great.
But
the way that it's tweaked, and it stays, like, really good throughout the Assassin's Creed games. I think that's one thing that you really have to give them is... up through all the ones I've played, I just got Odyssey and I haven't played it yet, but all the ones I've played and even the ones that I've seen do a really good job of taking the basic Altair costume, like the assassin costume, and then modifying it.
Yeah,
in a really
the hood
cool way.
And the belts and the cloaks.
Yeah,
but then you adapt it to a culture and a period.
And you get like Ezio with his like
but
cool.
Assassin's Creed 2 is where that really started to evolve, and they gave Ezio so many different costumes and like variants, and you can, you know, colorize your costume and tweak it. And sort of make it your own style.
And they're all like these nice Renaissance motifs. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's got the big puffy shoulders. I think Brotherhood and Revelations and Black Flag and 3, like, all, like, work really well. I think the 3 is the weak one of the chain because they were going to put it in cities.
They were going to a new engine and it had a lot of rough spots, but it had good ideas too.
Well, and also the interface was terrible. And also they put you in like colonial America where everything was like a thatched hut.
Yeah. They forgot to put you in.
Whoops.
They forgot the verticality.
Yeah. I mean, the last one I actually spent time with was Unity, which took place in Paris.
Paris, yeah.
And that was like, the game itself was okay. It was just like, oh, more Assassin's Creed. But the city... And, you know, climbing around on Notre Dame. That was amazing.
I'm really interested to see how Odyssey plays with it. Because I know very little. Like, I kind of stopped paying attention after Unity. Because I love those games. And then it just got to a point where I had played 8 of those games. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I'm very curious to see how they address that in later games. But Assassin's Creed 2. And I know that Uncharted kind of does the same thing. But, like, you see the fingerprints specifically of what you do in Assassin's Creed 2, like with Ezio and the free running and the climbing everywhere. Like, I've been playing God of War 2018 obsessively lately, and like, there's no reason for there to be climbing and jumping from place to place in that game. But Assassin's Creed kind of revolutionized what an open world game was.
It contributed a whole lot to just kind of the general canon of what you can do in this kind of game.
Yeah. And it was up to that point, I feel like, if not the best, like, 3D open world style platformer, certainly the most intuitive. I actually really like the run fast, run slow, like the high key, low key mechanic. Even though it was ditched later on, I think it's a very interesting way to go about it. The Abstergo stuff, they should have stopped. Like, it's pointless. But
It's, like I said, it took Kristen Bell to leave the series for them to say, okay, let's stop doing this.
Because all it does is, like, it throws a, like, it puts the brakes on action and drama in a really frustrating way. But I also really like that Assassin's Creed 2 does the big time skips.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That was something that struck me as, like, you start out as a young, callow Ezio, and then, like, I think your father is assassinated, murdered, and then it jumps ahead, like, 10 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
then the next two games jump ahead another like couple decades each. Like,
yeah. And then Ezio's an old man who can still like take 100-foot vertical drops. And he just kind of like goes, oh, my knees.
Every once in a while, it's like it starts to catch up with you. But,
he's no old snake. That's for sure.
Yeah.
But Assassin's Creed 2, big thumbs up.
Yeah,
you do get a gun in that game, which is amazing.
Yes.
So how does that compare to you, for you, to Batman Arkham Asylum, given that you are the world's foremost Batmanologist?
Arkham Asylum really set the standard for superhero games in a way that had not been done before. It was the first superhero game that made you feel like you were the superhero. And if you go back to 2018 and look at all the reviews of Spider-Man, the one thing that everyone who loved that game agrees on is the best part of the game is that it makes you feel like Spider-Man. Batman did that for Batman, where you could, like, it seems so simple, but, like, Batman should be able to fight 10 dudes at once. And you could. If somebody did not have an automatic rifle, you had no problem taking them out, which I thought was
great. Because my mom bat don't shiv.
Yeah, my mom bats don't shiv. He nasty.
He balls nasty.
Oh, I was hoping you wouldn't say it.
What the heck are you guys talking about?
But I feel like the Arkham Asylum is also, I love it. It is a deeply stupid game. It is a game that, but it's stupid in a very video gamey way, and it's stupid in a way that it commits to. It's not as stupid as Arkham City, which is just dumb as a bag of hammers. But I love that that is a game that they had to figure out how to make into a game.
Right.
So it's a game that ends with the Joker turning himself into a big monster you can punch.
Yeah.
And Batman puts explosives on his hands so that he can punch you with exploding hands, which has no ill effects on Batman.
Wow.
But I think it makes up for that. And the reason people like buy into it, and the reason people want to think that game is good, because you will still find people who are like, oh, but it's got such a good story. Paul Dini wrote it. And it's like, eh. Did he know? Is that it gets the atmosphere really well. And it also does really good Batman stuff. The game makes it very clear.
It's the first Batman game of note in which he's a detective.
Yeah.
It has detective mode.
Even though detective mode is...
It's just Metroid pointless. Prime.
Yeah. But like the game makes it really clear that Batman can leave Arkham Island at any time. He just doesn't because there's a job to do. And I think that's really, really cool. But yeah, like you get a lot of really good stuff. I think it makes crawling around in the ductwork fun in a way that I had never had fun with any other stealth-based games, because those stealth-based games did not end up with me being Batman.
I think that's actually an accomplishment, because crawling around in ductwork is usually really tedious.
Yeah,
so like making that fun is an accomplishment.
The reward that you get from picking off henchmen one by one until there's one guy left and he's terrified and he's like shooting at shadows, you get it, right? Like you get like
this is the first game to really like turn
the job.
I'm not trapped in here with you, you're trapped in here with me, into a game mechanic, into like the essence of the game.
Plus again, like the aesthetics of the game are dubious at best. This was the start of a Bad Harley Quinn.
Totally like just ignored this game for a long time, no matter how much people said it was good, because I was like, I do not want to see like Batman, you know, as a 300-pound slab of beef. That's not my vision of Batman.
4-foot-wide chest Batman.
This is
right?
Unreal Engine
Big
Batman.
Big cape Batman.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's just like everyone is so beefy. It's so gray and grim looking. It's not really my cup of tea, my cup of bat tea.
Yeah. I do like the commitment to the bat aesthetic, if that makes sense. Like,
see, I think Denny O'Neill when I think Batman.
No,
I think like
too. Like
mean
I'm a
guy with the long bat.
Yeah,
bat
I'm a Jim Aparo guy through and through. But I also like why didn't they give Poison Ivy pants? I don't know. They did not issue
her
pants.
It's a video game.
Yeah. But I do like that you can't like there is obviously like a gender disparity in the character design, which is bad. But also, like, if you look at the way they designed the male characters in those games, the male characters are also very stupid. They're just not, like, hypersexualized. Like,
right, there's a different kind of stupid.
Yeah, the Penguin doesn't have a monocle in Arkham City. He has the bottom of a beer bottle that's been shoved into his face, which doesn't make sense. But it's like, oh, right, in this world, there are no monocles. There's just, like, weird deformities. It's a ridiculously stupid game, but it's also, like, it gets so much right that you... It doesn't earn its failings, but it does make it so it is an enjoyable game to play despite its failings. And I think that you really can't take away how much it does right.
Yeah, this is a game that I definitely dismissed sight unseen because of its aesthetics, but over time I've been kind of won back over to what it does right. And, you know, a big thing that it does is kind of turn Arkham Asylum itself into a real space. It has a very Metroidvania,
it's a Metroidvania
feel to
yeah.
it.
We talked and, about that in the Metroidvania episode.
Yeah, like, it, you know, more so than Arkham City or Arkham Knight or whatever it was.
Which I didn't play because the car that you blow up other cars with turned me off on that one.
Yeah. Well, you know, you were only blowing up drones.
Drones. Mm-hmm. Only drones with your car. Only drones. With your gun on wheels.
Right. Yeah, so more so than the other games in the series, it feels very much about a place, a very finite space that you basically come to master.
Yes.
And that's cool.
Which I think has its apotheosis in the reveal that there's a secret Batcave underneath Arkham Asylum, because of course there is. Like, why wouldn't he have put one there?
You just spoiled the whole game for me. I just bought that game.
Man. The spoiler is that the Joker turns into a monster that you punched.
He's Venom the Joker, right?
Yeah. The other thing, like, obviously, like, they got Kevin Conroy and Mark Hamill to be Batman and the Joker, which was,
that's cool.
Kevin Conroy is the definitive Batman performer of our lives, which is really good.
And Mark Hamill, you never had to see his painted over mustache, so that makes him better than Cesar Romero.
How dare you?
Sorry, man. if you're going to commit to the role, commit to the role. Shave the mustache. It's fine. Yeah. Yeah.
But I also like the way that it approaches Batman, in that it takes place in a world, and this is something that you also see in other superhero games. Like, Spider-Man takes this same tack, where Spider-Man has been Spider-Man for 8 years, so he's 23 years old. He just hasn't fought Dr. Octopus yet, and he hasn't fought Green Goblin yet, because they were in movies.
Right.
And so he weirdly fights Mr. Negative before the Green Goblin exists. But going around in Arkham Asylum, like, you get all these hints, like, oh, Ra's al Ghul exists. Oh, Catwoman exists. Oh, like, all the stuff that you want to exist in a world of Batman, you have and you can play with in a really cool way. I don't know why Arkham has a... Like, if I was in charge of Arkham, I would have gotten rid of the Botanical Gardens, personally, first thing.
Especially if you were holding Poison Ivy.
Yeah. I would have maybe dealt with
maybe
that.
Don't give this lady her ammunition.
Yeah. I would have given her pants instead of a botanical garden.
But sounds like a plan.
Botanical pants.
You never bought me pants.
The big flaw with it is that you don't save anyone from dying. You just, like, temporarily save them from dying, which is a pain. Hmm. Which also Arkham City doubles down on. But again, like, it's capital D dark. Like, capital D with a Q-U-E dark. In a way that you kind of have
wasn't
to
that admire. An Image Comics character?
Dark. Dark. No, but, like, call me. Hit me up. I'll write Dark for you. I think there's a Master Dark in Valiant.
With a Q-U-E.
I think Valiant had a Master Dark.
That could be.
Yeah, Arkham Asylum, I think, really good. I don't think aesthetically it holds up today, but, I mean, if you look at games of the time, I think it fits right in with your Gods of War and your Gears of War and your what other war games were there?
I think you can also draw a very clear line between Batman Arkham Asylum and Demon's Souls, which also debuted in 2009. It was not quite Dark Souls yet, but did you guys play Demon's Souls?
Nope.
I think I have for a minute. I don't know.
A minute.
I was not really aware of that.
Really
get
you a hot minute.
Some years depth later. There.
Yeah.
Because this was, so, like, From Software was, like, kind of a very niche thing back in the day until they really
made, like,
hit it.
They made Armored Core.
They made some great things. Yeah, they made Armored Core. They made the, what are the fantasy ones?
Kingsfield.
The Kingsfield ones, they made great things, but I don't think they had a lot of sort of mainstream traction until we got all the way up to Dark
Souls. And to the point that this was a Sony-published game in Japan, and Sony was like, we're not publishing this outside of Japan. So Atlus stepped up and did it, and then Sony was like, oh, actually, you know, Namco also were like, oh, actually, this is really cool. Hey, FromSoft, how about you come and, you know, make us some games too? So we got Dark Souls, and we got Bloodborne and Sekiro.
Were these PS3 exclusive in 2009?
At the time, yes.
Okay.
Actually, Dark Souls might have been PS2 exclusive, but Demon's Souls was PS3 exclusive.
Okay.
It was a Sony-funded and published game in Japan, so it's never been on anything except PS3.
That might explain why I've never played it, because I had an Xbox at the time.
Well, the good news is that, actually, by the time that you hear this podcast, Bob is putting together a Demon's Souls podcast, so we will already have been through that whole journey, so we don't have to cover it here. But I feel like it does do kind of the same thing with virtual spaces as Arkham Asylum, like, except instead of you know, being about like you are Batman, you are indomitable, you can counter and attack and just like crush everyone. Demon's Souls is pretty much the opposite, where it's like you're going to die a lot. Death is actually a play mechanic, and when you die, you enter a spirit realm and have to restore yourself to life. So very difficult.
Oh.
So on the open world side of things, we have a few games. I don't know. Uncharted 2 isn't quite open world. It's actually it's the opposite. It's very linear, very cinematic. But there's Infamous, and there's Dragon Age Origins, and Sims 3. Just kidding.
I played that a little bit.
I like Dragon Age Origins.
By all accounts, Dragon Age Origins is very good. I really like BioWare, but I have very little tolerance for Western fantasy.
I've heard there's a lot of good fanfic based on it.
That would not surprise me. Because I think, in a lot of ways, I think the BioWare RPGs, because you have Mass Effect and Dragon Age, which are the same game. Mm. One has guns and the other one does not.
But they're also very much about their characters.
Yeah, they're very much about the world they create. And much in the same way that I think the strength of Mass Effect is that it has a really well-realized and interesting world full of like interesting species. Like, The thing I've said about
it's
Mass Effect is
Star Trek in as a video game.
Yeah, but Mass Effect is a good enough game that they have a race that is entirely sexy blue-skinned ladies, but it's not bad. Like, it's actually interesting.
Well, they also have a race that's like diaphanous, like space octopus.
Yeah,
and they're extremely religious.
Yeah,
they're like, come, brother, join. I don't have the reverb effect here, but come join our you know, tentacle cult.
Blasto the Henar Spectre is one of my favorite jokes in any video game ever. But I feel like Dragon Age is the same way. And I feel like if you want to talk about the one thing that sets it apart from other Western fantasy is that they made the elves Tolkien elves and Shoemaker elves at the same time. Because they're essentially like Tolkien elves. They're like high forest elf, but they have been basically made slaves by humans.
Oh yeah,
and I think
that.
That's
so.
Very,
that's who makes the cookies in the Dragon Age world.
Yeah, Keebler.
That's very dicey territory to get into narratively, and I'm not going to say that it is flawless, but I do think it is a very interesting setup that because of the way characters play out, specifically in Origins. I forget her name, but she's the She's she's BioWare character number three. She's the tall love one. Interest you feel sympathetic
she's
to.
She's Tsundere. Yeah. She, what's the opposite of Tsundere?
Yandere?
Yes, that's it.
God, I'm so embarrassed that I know that.
No, I knew I could count on you, Ben.
It is not shy about presenting you as a character who is in a society that is built on injustice, mm-hmm. which I think is really interesting because that's a very
common... I've heard it has a lot of really interesting racial dynamics and actually like plays with them in interesting ways.
They do the same thing with the mages where, they will essentially take people who can do magic and put them in cloisters. And if they misbehave, they lobotomize them so that they can't do magic anymore, which is very dark fantasy tropey. Mm-hmm. In a way that I think is super common in postmodern fantasy fiction, but it's executed really well and executed very interestingly in a way that makes Origins enjoyable, makes 2 for me, which I know everybody hated 2, but like the larger world building stuff made 2 at least tolerable for me and makes Inquisition really, really good, I think.
All right. So we have already been talking about this for an hour. So I want to finish this podcast. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through a list of all the games that we identified as major releases for the year. And each of you are going to identify one that you want to talk about. We will talk about that for like 5 minutes or so and then move on to the next and wrap it up.
Ben? So I actually wanted to real quick like try to tie together some of the things in here that are not the big AAA releases.
Okay, well, we're going to go through the whole list really quickly.
Okay.
We can each say one sentence about these games. So make it a very impressive run-on sentence, Ben.
This is going to be a hell of a run-on sentence.
All right, here we go. Uncharted 2. Thoughts?
One of the most like enjoyable attempts at doing movie as video game, I think. Very fun.
Ben? Never played it.
Ben?
Moving on.
Okay. Infamous. Really, you're like Mr. Superhero. You only like real superhero games?
And I didn't play it. I played the... What's the other one?
Prototype.
Prototype. Yes, played, the one with the dark thing. Yeah.
The games that are basically the same game.
They are the same. Time. It's like the deep, Deep Impact versus... I just forgot the Bruce Willis one.
Armageddon.
Yes. Yeah.
I played
Ants versus A Bug of Life.
But
I played Prototype and thought it was very fun.
Okay.
You know, I think I actually got a free copy of Infamous from somewhere and never got around to playing it, which is how much of an impression it made on me.
One of them was on either PlayStation Plus or...
Yeah.
I think it was had to be on PlayStation like Plus,
that.
And it I got
whatever
it.
Whatever came before
it.
That, yeah.
First Light, I think.
Yeah, they struck me as too angry, so I never really messed with them.
Yeah,
I didn't play that one.
Sims 3.
I played that one.
Yes?
Yeah, what do you think about Sims 3, Benj?
It was good. I bought it for my wife, who is a big fan of Sims 1 and 2.
Thank you.
And they had a good... we're married, aren't we? Also,
no, big fan of Sims.
Okay. So that's the joke. For my it's wife. My name. Thank you.
It's funny because it's his last
name. My name is the name of a very popular video game franchise. That's
shoot, man. Okay. So they had a good port for the iOS version of it, but it got axed for freeware, freemium. Yeah. Versions. But yeah, Sims 3 is a good game.
How is it different than Sims 2?
Better graphics. More
woohoo
and money and showers and buying groceries and stuff. You know all that stuff. Mansions. Lots of add-ons, of course. Dozens.
All right.
That's all I know.
I gave Bench my sentences for this one. I'm saving mine up.
Okay. Yeah. The Beatles Rock Band. I played this a lot.
You did?
I used to have a good singing voice. It changed about 5 years ago, and I lost my ability to sing. It's very sad.
I played some Rock Band, but I did not actually play the Beatles spinoff.
Yeah, like... Oh man, back at 1UP, like one time I jumped in and just randomly picked up Tom Sawyer by Rush, and people were like, what the hell is happening? Nice. He can do that? He can do Geddy Lee? Yes, I can. I could once upon a time. But Beatles was great because it was music that everyone knew. And there aren't a whole lot of like vocal gymnastics in the Beatles. So it was kind of like they didn't have a whole lot of hard mode type stuff, but it was, playing instruments, singing Lennon and McCartney songs, very just like a good family kind of gathering sort of.
Yeah, my problem with Rock Band vocals is I'm more of a tenor, and a lot of pop songs are not.
Really? I feel like pop songs are mostly tenor.
A lot of them go higher than I go.
I see.
I'm a huge obsessive.
I'm mostly bass.
Bass. I'm Paul. Yeah, I play bass.
I'm a huge obsessive Beatles fan, but I had no desire to play this game.
Really?
Only regret is that It was my only chance to have an excuse to interview Paul McCartney because it was a video game related
thing. Did you interview him?
No.
No.
Of course not. I would have just retired at that moment. But anyway. So, yeah, I never
played. You could have interviewed him for Destiny also.
Yeah. Yeah. Gosh. Oh, my goodness.
So, oh, my goodness.
Oh, my goodness.
Can't believe I'm singing for Destiny.
That's an Irish accent.
I know. Whatever. Whatever. Liverpool, whatever. Ireland, it's all the same, right? Yeah. No?
Please address your complaints to Jeremy Parrish.
Please me.
Yeah, let's not.
They're all on an island someplace.
Oh. All overseas.
Aren't we all, though? Ouch.
In truth, this little island Earth.
Yes.
I want to call the Scottish guy English online, and I never heard the end of it 20 years later.
I'm very aware that there are very distinctions between England and Scotland and Ireland and North Ireland and Wales.
That's good. Yeah, yes. People cannot get jokes.
I was just making a goofy joke about Paul McCartney. Yes. That's all.
Moving on.
All right. Flower.
I've been saving up some sentences for one. All right. So part of what I wanted to talk about is just like the way, as we talked about at the beginning of the podcast, we were in this kind of intermediate period where we hadn't started getting all the indie things online. And like, I think PS2 had, because it had such a huge install base, had this big flowering of like experimental stuff on it that actually got published. And we were sort of at the tail end of that winding down. So we got a few on PS3, and Flower was one of them, and it was awesome. So it was that game company. They started out doing Flow, that was like a Flash game. It got picked up by Sony, and then they made this, and it was just like, this is like the most relaxing video
peaceful
game I have ever played. But it also has this like whole emotional journey that plays out through the levels without, like, there's literally not like a single word of text.
But it's not
game.
Journey.
It's not Journey. That's their next game, which does the same sort of thing, only more so. But yeah, it just, it's like just pulls off this incredible aesthetic and like emotional feel with like zero text and zero characters. You're like, you are a flower petal. You control the wind to blow yourself through these settings and pick up more flower petals. But it just manages through pure aesthetics and setting to evoke a lot of emotions. And I thought that was a really cool accomplishment.
So is this your 5-minute game?
My what?
I said, you know, we'll go through the list and everyone identify a game that you want to talk about for 5 minutes.
I mean, I just took 2 minutes on it. Whatever. I'll save my other 3 minutes for the other thing.
Okay.
All right,
but yeah, anytime you guys, we come across a game that you want to talk about, you each get one game to dig into. So
I have one.
Who's tackling Fat Princess?
Well, I did.
I don't know what this is.
I added it to the list, but this is not my 5-minute game. I just thought it was cool because at the time I had a PS3 and I had, in-laws, like my
wife. What was Fat Princess, though?
It's a party, team-based party, capture the flag type game where it's cartoony over, like, overhead.
It almost feels like an early MOBA kind of thing, except I don't really understand MOBA.
It reminds me of, like, Capture the Flag mode in Quake or something, but with cartoon characters, and it's a sort of light fantasy setting with a princess and knights and archers and things. And there's a whole team defending the other team's princess who's trying to snatch your princess back from the other team, who's fat, of course. And you try to keep feeding it cake or something to keep it fat so it's hard to drag around. And then
the premise is a little problematic.
Yeah, well, that was so fun about it at the time because it was so completely unpolitically correct. But it was a really fun team game because it's very silly and weird and cartoony. And it's a great 4-player game. You can play 4 people at a time and choose your roles if you want to be an archer or mage. Whatever, and then you defend. You know, some people defend the castle. Some people go out and be offensive to try to get it back, the princess back. And I know I'm saying it. That's a horrible thing, but to get her back, you know. And so, it's a really cool game.
I played a few rounds of it. Yeah, it's a cartoony party game. Capture the flag.
I played it more Fat Princess on PS3 as a party game with 4 people than most of the other games, other than Little Big Planet maybe. So it's a neat indie game.
All right. Borderlands. Any thoughts?
I've actually, well, I played it briefly, but I never got into it.
Yeah,
never
it's a shooter.
It. Yeah.
Yeah,
loot shooter.
Schluter.
I haven't really played it.
It thinks it's funnier than it is. Oh, well.
Yeah.
Bayonetta. Surely. Chris? Surely, Chris Sims, this is your opportunity.
We're
to
We're passing this one to Chris.
The baton is yours.
Bayonetta rules. Bayonetta rules. It is a beautiful and perfect game about a woman who has guns on her feet so that she can kick you in the face and shoot you in the face at
also,
the same time.
Everything is made of hair.
Everything's made of hair.
And she's sometimes a space harrier.
The hair is demons.
Hair.
And then there's angels.
Also, the end of the game is that you... I'm pretty sure it's Bayonetta 1. The end of the game is that you ride a motorcycle up a rocket and then punch God. Which is great.
So, like a sequel to Final Fantasy Legend.
Sure, why not? No.
Like Star Trek V.
I love Bayonetta.
What does God need with a punch in the face from a motorcycle?
An attitude readjustment, evidently.
Bayonetta is... Arkham Asylum, I talked about being kind of dragged down by its aesthetics, but it kind of, you know, it's good enough that you can get through them and be like, oh, okay, yeah, this is, I get it, it's dumb. Bayonetta is a game that uses aesthetics that at first look dumb, but then turn out to be brilliant to get you in the door to play the game. And the, it is always very funny to me when people are like into Bayonetta, because I feel like Bayonetta is so far beyond what the word sexy means that she is definitely not.
I mean,
she was
over the top.
Sarah Palin as a angel goddess warrior.
I prefer to think Baroness, but okay.
Sure.
Yeah,
but
I mean,
look, consider the time, consider the media landscape.
Mm.
Yeah,
but she's also, I mean, she's also kind of this like fashion. Like fashion design sketch kind of thing. Because I mean, she was designed by a woman who's into
weird,
like fashion stuff.
Huge, like she's got the weirdly
long
elongated.
Long...
It's like Naoko Takeuchi drawings, like, you know, weirdly elongated body, hands, neck. And the performance aspect, like the performative aspect of what she is doing as a character makes what she is doing, like what she is physically doing in the game, so much more interesting and is kind of like a. Very much a rejection of what was going on in like super bro-y games, i.e. God of War. And the way that plays out and the way that it ends up being this weird thing where you're fighting angels who actually are like giant four-faced babies and wheels made of eyes, I think is very fun and compelling. The only big problem with the game is that the backgrounds are all very kind of samey tan brown.
Similar.
But I think that is made up for it. Like that kind of has to be like that so that the characters can be.
Yeah.
Also the Fly Me to the Moon shooting up the graveyard sequence at the beginning is one of the best openings.
Wait, did they actually play Fly Me to the Moon?
They play a cover of Fly Me to the Moon while
the next Netflix version of Bayonetta does not have that.
She is dressed as a nun fighting angels in a graveyard. And it's beautiful. It's hilarious.
She's a very particular aesthetic, like brung to life and like recontextualized in weird ways.
I feel like Bayonetta is a beautiful game. There's acrobatics and it's beyond sexy. It's like what you said. It's like it's not sexy. It's like incredible. It's very... Like in a way that's not human. That's supernatural. And she has 6 foot long legs and she's like graceful and crazy and the aesthetics are amazing and the enemies are weird and supernatural and like angelic and stuff, like you said. I think Bayonetta is a work of art, honestly. I played it for a fairly long time. I never finished the game, but I really enjoyed. Like, I remember, this is what I remember. I remember, like, at that time, I mean, there were folks like Jen Frank who was talking about women's issues in games and how they're portrayed and all that stuff. I think she liked Bayonetta a lot. I think there were other women who enjoyed the sort of empowerment of this character in this world. And it was interesting to see that because some people were holding it up on blogs as like this hyper-sexualized woman that could never possibly exist. And then there's other women who are like, no, wait, this is really cool and powerful.
So, and I think one of the things that made a big difference there is she's like a sexualized but empowered woman who is actually designed by a woman.
Yeah, there you go.
As opposed to being some man's fetish.
And in all fairness, we are a room full of dudes.
That's true.
So
yes.
I would encourage you to go seek out other people's opinions on Bayonetta.
Absolutely.
It much like I feel very similarly to this game as I did with Lollipop Chainsaw. And I wrote about Lollipop Chainsaw and how people... There is always a pit that you fall into when you are using exploitative imagery to make a point about exploitation, because mm-hmm. you're still using exploitative imagery, even though mm-hmm. you're trying to make a point. But I feel like both of those games are smarter about what they're doing than a lot of people initially gave them credit for. And I think Bayonetta is very upfront with its whole deal, I guess, on every level. Mm-hmm. The one place where I think Bayonetta fails on the front of its commentary on hypersexualization is Joy the name of the villain that you...
The sort of counterpart rival?
No, it's one of the angels. I believe its name is Joy. It's the female presenting angel, and you kind of like bondage her to death in a way that is more explicit Ooh. Than the normal bondage imagery that's going on in Bayonetta. Mm-hmm. But yes. like...
I didn't get that far.
Yeah, I haven't seen she's that. Like a mid-game, like mini-boss, I think. But overall, I've like...
Sounds fascinating.
Right. I think Jeremy's going to hit us if we don't move on here.
Bandit is very, very good. I love it. The end.
All right. So next on the list, someone put this in bold. New Super Mario Brothers Wii. Who was that?
Me.
All right, this is your 5 minutes. Go for it.
Be Jeremy's
yeah,
thing,
but. This is the only game we should have talked about the whole time. No, wait,
we've already done a new Super Mario Brothers episode.
That's true, yeah. Well,
you just weren't there, sorry.
Oh, okay. Well, then I didn't do it. So, New Super Mario Brothers Wii was a groundbreaking experience for me on Nintendo console, because I had previously played Little Big Planet, which I've mentioned before, which was the first four-player simultaneous platform game in the modern era that did it really well. And I thought while I was playing Little Big Planet, I was like, man, this is putting Nintendo to shame. They should make something like this with Mario. And so New Super Mario Bros. Wii basically did that. It has four-player simultaneous platforming like Little Big Planet. You can interact with each other. You can pick each other up, toss each other around, carry each other through things. And I sat down and played this with my brother-in-law, my two sister-in-laws, and like, I don't know, some... How many sister-in-laws do I have? Okay, yeah, two brother-in-laws and two sister-in-laws, and we had a damn good time. It was the most fun I've ever had with a video game with a group of people. We were laughing raucously and just... It was incredible. It's a really fun game. I mean, at that time, just the experience of playing four people at once on a platform, a Nintendo platform game with Mario, was groundbreaking and fun. I mean, do you guys, did you do that back then?
Absolutely. And this is a point that I really stressed in the New Super Mario Brothers episode, is that like your feelings on this game really depend on how many people you've played it with, because solo, it's mm-hmm. fine. It's a good Mario game,
yeah.
But when you play it together, it really takes on a new life of its own. And I have a lot of really fond memories of playing this. And yeah, like it's, you know, both professionally and personally, it's just a fantastic game.
When didn't you rate, was it this or was it the Wii U sequel that you
the
rated?
Wii U sequel.
The Wii U sequel you rated as on top of your Mario rank list.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Chris?
Oh, I don't play games with other people.
You don't? Well,
I normally have, don't, but this was an exception. Yeah.
No, I had it, and like you said, like it was a very good Mario game, but I never had the experience of multiplayer.
Yeah.
So,
which is
it was just a very
definitely
good.
A strong point.
Yeah. Four of us in this room.
Yeah. Let's play it right now. I got it. My
backpack. No, I've got a Wii right down here, and
yeah,
we got been plenty playing of Wii time. This entire time, Jeremy.
Yeah, I like, well, the interactions between the characters, you can accidentally bounce off each other and stuff, which makes it hilarious. Like, basically, you know, going against the best interests of each other by accident. I'm sure there's a shorter word for that, but I forgot it. And helping each other, too, cooperatively.
It's probably German.
Yeah, Vision, Schneidenspoten. Yeah, whatever.
Okay.
Something like that. So, I'm just going to stop talking.
So you can bounce off each
what
other.
Time is it?
Moving on again.
Yeah. No, it's a great game.
The
thing I want to emphasize about it is just that multiplayer aspect was groundbreaking at the time for a Nintendo game, and it was just an absolute blast to play. And solo, yes, Jeremy's right. It's sort of like, yeah, this is a cool game, but the real star is four-player co-op Mario platforming, which is insane. Or it was at that time.
I agree. Pokemon Heart Gold, Soul Silver. Yeah, a remake. Wrong game. Wrong generation.
Okay, that was actually Gen 3. But anyways.
Is this your 3 minutes?
No. Okay. No, absolutely not.
It was very good, and mostly I played this game because it came with a pedometer, and I was very into like getting as much walking done as I could for health. And so I would walk to the train like a mile every day, get the train, take it to work, then walk like half a mile to the office. I would take the long route. I could have like made this trip in like 2 blocks, but I was like, no, it's good for my health. So I got a lot of use out of Pokemon Heart Gold, Soul Silver. Because so
it was the egg catching mechanic for the walking
Pokemon. I don't even remember. It was something. A thing that it tracked my steps, and I was like, okay. Yeah, I've been walking
that's
a lot.
What I use
I'm healthy.
Go for now.
I accidentally ran over my Pokewalker.
Oh,
it was tragic.
That is very tragic.
Yeah.
So this was a little pedometer that came with the game, and it was kind of like a cross between a pedometer and a VMU from a Dreamcast, and it could connect by Wi-Fi or no by infrared to the cartridge. Yeah.
Yeah, you could put a Pokemon in it and walk around.
Yeah, absolutely.
Really, really great game. I think it underlines why Nintendo can get away with remaking Pokemon games so often, because every time they remake them, they are both like substantially improved and also like really good and have new stuff in a way that other like reissues and remakes don't.
Yeah.
Really good game.
The Legend of Zelda Spirit Tracks. People hate this game.
I liked it.
You're Link in a little engineer outfit driving a train around.
Fun. I realize like the DS Zeldas are not the most beloved. And admittedly, I think part of my deal here was I hadn't really played Zelda since Super Nintendo because I didn't have Nintendo's consoles after that. But so I came back to Zelda with Phantom Hourglass and Spirit Tracks, and I really just had a good time. They're not the best Zeldas of all time.
Oh, they're very good, though.
But they're good. And I thought, the touch mechanics were a little gimmicky, but I thought they worked. Like, I liked the little, like, vine whip thing.
But Princess Zelda is a ghost who follows around you with you, and she turns into a suit of armor and kills stuff.
You can make Zelda into a Stalfos. Yeah, it's awesome. I liked this game a lot.
How I feel about that game is... I had bought every single Zelda game ever made up to that point, and this is when I stopped. It was my last obligatory Zelda purchase. I mean, the one before this one. What was it? Phantom Hourglass?
Phantom Hourglass was the one
this
before.
This game sucked. It was terrible.
It had some issues.
Because of the controls. That's why it sucked.
So, you didn't like the touch controls?
No, I hated that.
I thought they actually kind of worked. I mean, they were gimmicky. I'm not sad to see them go away again, but I thought they worked reasonably well.
But I could see, I've actually never played Spirit Tracks, so it might be a great game. I just didn't want to buy it. I didn't want to play it.
All right. Scribblenauts, also on DS. This is kind of like Minecraft, but for words.
Yeah, I like
that. I actually like this one.
Scribblenauts is a lot of fun. I love it. Yeah.
It's fun. You make up words to solve puzzles. Right?
Yeah. So the premise of this is you have this like 2D sort of these short 2D stages, like a little bit of platforming, and there's like characters in them, and there's you, and somewhere there's a star that you're supposed to get. And the gimmick is you have this magic notebook and you write a word and it makes that thing. And the game actually has a pretty dang large vocabulary of things you can make, and you can apply adjectives to them. So you can make a red thing or a big thing or a angry thing. And then the things you make interact with the rest of the world. And it's a really cool concept, and it's impressive the degree to which they pulled it off.
It is it is incredibly smart.
Yeah.
Because it can interpret so many things that you put in. I played the DC Comics version that came out.
There was a spinoff with like all the heroes in
it. Which is like such a good idea. Like in a just world, there would be as many of those as there are like Lego superheroes games. Because they're so fun. And
I would totally go for different licenses with this game, yeah.
Yeah. I played Unlimited the most, and the most fun I had with that was I actually turned it into a feature on 1UP.com called Me and My Cthulhu.
Yes.
And I basically just tried to use Cthulhu as the solution for everything. And it was amazing how versatile Cthulhu is. Like the unknowable horror of non-Euclidean space solves so many problems.
You make like a flying, rideable, friendly Cthulhu, and it'll oblige you. And there you go. Yeah.
All right, Mario and Luigi, Bowser's Inside Story. You guys play this?
Nope.
It was cute and fun. It was okay.
I think this was the only Mario and Luigi RPG that I missed.
Oh, it was good. Yeah, a lot of it you played as Bowser, and sometimes you played as Mario and Luigi inside of Bowser's guts. It was kind of weird, but it was good.
That is weird.
I never got around to any of the Mario and Luigi games, and if I did, I thought that's the one I wanted to try, but I haven't done it yet.
Dragon Quest IX, I have a lot to say about this
game. It was good.
But we don't have a lot of time, so I'm going to save it for many other podcasts. But basically, this is Dragon Quest as a sort of semi-open world portable game.
Like make your own party.
Yeah, you can team up with other players and adventure together.
It had a lot of very somewhat clunky like online connectivity things you could do.
It had the Street Pass element talk, like you put your DS in a pre-Street Pass mode. And, you know, if you passed to other people who were playing the game and Street Passing, which was great for PAX, or in Japan, they would enter your game and stay at your inn, and they would give you stuff, and you could get cool things that way. There was a year's worth of weekly updates where characters from previous games would come and hang out in your town and bring you costumes and things like that.
Well, the other thing you could trade was these semi-randomly generated treasure maps, which had these like procedural dungeons, but they were made from a few seeds. And so then people would start seeing the same maps and word would pop up about which maps were really good. So there were these famous maps,
the Kawasaki map.
There were these maps that were full of like metal slime emperors or whatever that were great from XP grinding. And people would literally trade these maps person to person around the world. And so I actually, the first time after Dragon Quest IX came out, I took it down to Dragon Con and did a meetup. And I think I was a significant part of spreading the Kawasaki map around the Southeast.
You are patient zero.
Yeah.
All right. Kingdom Hearts 358 over 2 days. That is how it's pronounced. Picross. I skipped Picross 3D.
Picross 3D is great.
Is it?
Yes. It's awesome. I know, we're running out of time. Picross, yeah, it's Picross. It's in 3D. You've got these cubes instead of squares, and you're drilling down into this thing inside, and it's just a great little puzzle game. And I know we don't have time, but it's awesome. You should check it out if you like puzzle games.
Okay. Metroid Prime Trilogy. It's Metroid Prime and 2 and 3 on Wii with updated controls for 1 and 2.
Like worse controls?
No.
Yeah. I played Metroid Prime 1 on the GameCube and that's all I need to know.
What? No, the Wii point and shoot command system was great.
It depends on your room configuration, how well the sensor bar was set up, whether you have interference from light coming into a window.
Well, I mean, if you set it up in a bad room, sure. That's like saying, yeah, if I like step on my controller, this Mario game isn't very fun. But
I had a bad room.
Clearly, no. I mean the Wii, the Wii remote based controls made Metroid Prime 1 and 2 really good. It was a big improvement, in my opinion.
I'll try it. By the time I went to buy that, it was hard to find. I think I don't remember. I know it's on the Wii U download stuff or whatever. Anyway.
All right, retro game challenge.
I think I'm gonna take my other 3 minutes on this. My other 2 minutes on this one.
You've been cut down to two.
Cut down to two. Okay, so I was talking about like the sort of indie-ish stuff was kind of winding down on PlayStation because PS2 had this huge install base, PS3 didn't. You got less of this. Some of it got picked up on DS, and we started to get some of those like weird niche retro and indie-ish things from Japan. And I think this was one of those things where like people had like people who are into retro stuff knew about Retro Game Challenge and wanted it, and finally XSEED went and did a localization of it, and it was fantastic. So this is basically your NES childhood fictionalized the DS game. And so you're like in this room and you have these like games that are very much like several different genres that were big on NES, but they're like new versions of it, like they're just made up. And then you have these things that are like the equivalent to Nintendo Power, and you can literally look up cheat codes for the games you're playing, and there's this disembodied head that's giving you weird challenges about them, and it's just this amazing, weird, fictionalized retro experience, and it just captured the feeling of, you know, sitting on the floor in the 80s with your NES, only with a whole new set of weird games, and it was great. And has Retronauts done an episode on this?
We haven't. I feel like that's one with Ray Barnhold.
Okay.
Since he actually worked on the fan translation.
Yeah.
The second,
okay. Yeah, the second one came out and sadly never got translated because sort of the market for this sort of stuff, it kind of dried up then.
Yep. But speaking of retro revivals, there was Castlevania the Adventure Rebirth, which is nothing to do with Castlevania the Adventure.
That's I added that to the list.
It's Christopher Belmont, and then that's it. That's the only similarity.
But it's good. It's a good.
It's pretty good. Yeah,
I really enjoyed it.
Street Fighter IV. Street Fighter finally came back after like 12 years.
Yeah, there had not been a new Street Fighter in a long ass
since like 1999. So it was a decade, they finally brought it back.
And
it
was
that
like,
was
okay,
the home release. The arcade version came out the previous year, I think.
Yeah. It had been in arcades for a year, and then it finally came out.
Suikoden Tear Crease, that's no good.
It's not a terrible game. It's not just good. Not a great Suikoden game.
Good. It's not good.
Suikoden? It's not Suikoden?
Nope.
Suikoden. I think it's a decent RPG. It just disappointed Suikoden fans because it's like a parallel universe, and it's not really what we wanted from another Suikoden. But it's a decent RPG. Okay. Handheld RPG.
Nobi Nobi Boy.
Yeah, that's what Keita Takahashi did after Katamari, because Namco was just going to rehash Katamari forever, and Keita's like, I want to do something else. And he made this, and it's basically just a playground, because he also designs playgrounds. And he's like, I'm going to make a digital playground, and you're just going to play and do stuff. And he did.
So the weird thing about that game is the cumulatively all the players beat it together over time.
Yeah, like so
that.
Like you have they this little, Pluto, the player character is this little stretchable dude that you're like controlling. It's actually a really interesting control scheme. Like you have your dual sticks and you're controlling the front
the character's
half
the named Boy.
The character's named Boy. You control the front half of Boy and the back half of Boy with your two control sticks, and so you can stretch him out and wrap him around things. And then after you were done playing, like your stretching got added to the cumulative length of Girl, who initially went off from the Earth to the Moon and then to Mars, and then they had to start introducing like bonus multipliers because distances in space are ridiculous. But yeah, eventually we got like Girl all the way to Pluto and back. And
I played the game years later on the PS3, and I was like, when did I beat this game? Why does it say I finished it? I don't understand.
Because everyone finished
it together.
I didn't
know that it was like a group.
Yeah, it's just, it was this collaborative thing, which was kind of cool.
Plants vs. Zombies? Plants vs. Zombies? Cool game, PopCap.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like a take on the tower defense genre, which is still a thing.
I enjoyed Plants vs. Zombies. I think I probably played it on the iPad or something first.
It was kind of a stripped down tower defense, right? Because it was strictly like right to left marching, and you just put things down one side.
Right, and the sequel was more of a first-person shooter, but the original was kind of a tower defense game.
Yeah.
And,
and it was very much just like an online web game of the era originally, and then it sort of... went everywhere.
Anyway, this kind of got bogged down in a few different topics that we didn't expect to, but hopefully our look back at the games of 2009, the big games of 2009, has kind of given us a sense of maybe how the medium has evolved since then. I feel like there are a lot of, you know, kind of seeds that were planted in 2009 or the continued growing that are relevant now, certainly with Minecraft and things like that. And you know, even Batman, like, you know, Spider-Man is a big thing. Insomniac was just purchased by Sony. So clearly, the big players believe in that style of game. So, or at least superheroes or whatever the hell.
But at the same time, we were just starting to see like the very beginnings of the rise of the whole like online indie game scene that we have that is ubiquitous now. Mm-hmm. Like there's millions of indie games coming up all the time through Steam, and then they end up on all the platforms. And we didn't have that then, but like the seeds were there. It was starting to happen.
Yep. So 2009, a pretty big year. And we are living in the shadow of it here a decade later. But I think that's it. That's all for now. And next year we'll look back at 2010. Why not? Why the hell not? In the meantime, keep playing modern video games and keep playing old video games. And here to promote old video games, yes, Chris?
Real quick, since like we moved past it really fast, if you seek out any game that we have talked about, it should be Retro Game Challenge, because that game is incredible.
It is amazing.
Brilliantly crafted.
And you, people should have bought more copies of it
people
at the time,
have bought more copies
so they could have gotten the sequel.
So we got the sequel.
But like, it's not difficult to, like, it's not expensive. I bought it because I was watching Game Center CX, and there's a bunch of really good making of featurettes on the show. And I ended up just buying it. I think I got it for like $5 off Amazon a couple years ago. It's really, really good and really smart.
They put a lot of love into it,
yeah,
both in the development and the localization of it.
And if you like this show, then you will like that game.
I feel like everyone who's listened to this show
kind of retronauts
has
the
played this game.
I haven't played it.
You don't
you
listen
should.
To the
well,
show.
You should.
You're right.
Yeah. See? Gotcha.
That's all.
Okay. Well, anyway, in advocacy of old games, this has been Retronauts. You can find Retronauts on iTunes and other pod catchers. Look for Retronauts. Retronauts.com is also a good place to go because we put everything there. And you can support us on Patreon to get every episode a week early and a higher bitrate with no advertisements. $3 a month, which is less than a cup of coffee at many places. We'll get all these things for you. And it also helps feed us coffee and other such things. So that's good. It's a noble endeavor. Everyone benefits all around, and that's great. Anyway, guys, where can we find you? Let's go with Chris from the beginning.
You can find me at the-isb.com. That's my blog that I mentioned way back at the start of the show. It has links to everything that I do, including other podcasts, comic books that I write, columns that I write, ways to get in touch with me if you want to give me work. Please don't tell me I'm wrong about Bayonetta, because I'm not. And I'm also on that terrible website, Twitter, which is at the ISB.
And I'm Benj Edwards. You can find me lurking on Twitter at Benj Edwards. And that's about it.
And I'm Ben Elgin. I am also on the Twitters at Kirin, K-I-R-I-N-N. Maybe someday I'll revive some blogs or do a podcast or something, but that day is not today.
All right. And you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, on Twitter as GameSpite, but you can also find me on Retronauts pretty much every week. So check back next week and hear me again.
Spring is sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards. Save big.